Pray with me. That which you have entrusted unto us, may we hear and heed and find a reason to hope. In the name of your Son, we pray. Amen. In 1862, Abraham Lincoln is into his first year of his presidency. The Civil War is at full tilt. The White House has just undergone some pretty massive renovations, all at the hand of his wife, Mary. And it was at her discretion and even encouraged by those around her that, given the somber atmosphere of a nation in war, it was still fitting that they would hold a celebration for this beautiful new people's house, the White House. And so they scheduled a celebration there on the grounds of the building. But around that time, their second and third sons, Tad and Willie, contracted typhoid fever. The White House, it turns out, had its water supply coming from the nearby Potomac River, where it happened to be where Union soldiers were encamped. And so where Union soldiers contracted typhoid, somehow their disease got all the way to the White House and infected two of the president's own children. Tad and Willie came down with it. It was a very severe case of it, even though the doctor came up and just diagnosed it sort of nebulously as some bilious fever. Well, with the celebration there upon them, it was Mary's wondering if they should cancel the event. But at the encouragement of the doctor, he said, not to worry, just do it, he'll be fine. And on the night of the celebration, Mary and Abraham slipped upstairs to check in on Willie to see how he was doing. In a few days' time, Tad would revive. But Willie, at the age of 11, would succumb. He would die of typhoid fever. And in the days following his death, Abraham himself wrote, which is on the back of your bulletin, these words: "My poor boy, he was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know that he is much better off in heaven. But then we loved him so much, it is hard, hard to have him die." George Saunders is an author of our day. He's from Amarillo, Texas. He writes short stories. He writes novels. His most recent book is entitled Lincoln in the Bardo. Bardo is a Buddhist term to refer to that mode of existence between death and renewal. And it refers actually not to Abraham Lincoln, but to Willie. And in that book, I'm told, George Saunders imagines what it was like for Abraham to face the death of his son. Legend has it, Abraham went to his son's grave on any number of occasions, if nothing more than to be near his body. But in George Saunders' imaginary retelling of that moment, he gets inside of Abraham's head, and there also on the back of your bulletin, he imagines Abraham saying this: "This is a trap, a horrible trap. At one's birth it is sprung. Some last day must arrive when you will need to get out of this body bad enough. And then we bring a baby here. The terms of the trap are compounded. That baby also must depart. All pleasures should be tainted by that knowledge. But hopeful, dear us, we forget. Lord, what is this? All of this walking about, trying, smiling, bowing, joking, this sitting down at table, pressing of shirts, tying of ties, shining of shoes, planning of trips, singing of songs in the bath, when he is to be left out here. Is a person to nod, dance, reason, walk, discuss as before? A parade passes. He can't rise and join. Am I to run after it, take my place, lift my knees high, wave a flag, blow a horn?" That might have been what Lincoln thought. "I am the father of a child who died in my arms, and in this room I am not alone in that experience. But I remember the first time I walked into a grocery store after she was dead and buried, and I thought to myself, how can you be walking around here shopping? Picking up chocolate-covered raisins. Don't you know what happened? This normalcy, isn't it just absurd? For 8 weeks, brothers and sisters, we have been listening to one man say one thing over and over again. That if you look hard enough into this life, if you look deep enough into the questions that naturally come across your brain, at some point you will think to yourself, this makes no sense. This is absurd. And kids, you've heard us say that word absurd 100 times in the last 8 weeks. Let me put it in terms that I hope will make sense to you. You know what it is to be absurd? When your kitty cat dies, or when you have an aunt and uncle that dies, or when you have a mommy and daddy that you don't understand what's going on, and you ask the question why, and any answer you get back doesn't make sense or doesn't help, guess what? You've just found out what it means to come into contact with something that's absurd. When the answer just doesn't good enough, when it just doesn't seem to explain anything, when it doesn't really help, then you know what absurd means. And the preacher of Ecclesiastes has been saying to us over and over again, do you realize if you look deep into stuff, it's just absurd? The passage that we're about to listen to says that, but it doesn't only say that. The preacher is kind enough to speak honestly to us, but he's also kind enough not just to leave us there. He wants to give us some sort of help, whatever meager help that might be. And the simple point that he's going to make through this very odd and bizarre sort of imagery is this. Rejoice in the light you have, because soon it's going to be dark. Listen to how he says it in his own way that nobody else can, from chapter 11 and chapter 12. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of a song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home. And the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. This is the honest, sobering word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Rejoice in the light you have, for soon it will be dark. That is his word to us. Take just that first part. Rejoice in the light you have. What does he mean? He is saying to us, brothers and sisters, light is precious. Do you see that everything that is around you was not promised you? Do you see that any goodness that you might have in this life was not expected? It was not a given. And therefore, it is yours and my responsibility, if you will, to consider that everything that's mundane, everything that might frustrate us or exasperate us, there is still everything that circumscribes that a goodness and a gift to it. Your light, for as long as you have it, is precious. And so he says unto us, if that is the case, rejoice. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth. That is not the sort of banal sentimentality of Bobby McFerrin saying, don't worry, be happy. That is this preacher saying unto you, you're not just to be happy. You are actually commissioned to a fact-finding mission. Your responsibility in this life is to go find the wonder in everything. Your responsibility in this life is to find the goodness, the gratuitousness of it all, the brilliance that has been bestowed unto you. That's your job. Anne Lamott is an author that my family loves. She says a lot of things that trouble me to no end. I think, oh my gosh, I can't believe she said that. But there's a lot of stuff that she says that I say to myself, I wish I'd said that. And one of the things that she has said of late is this: all truth is a paradox. Life is a precious, unfathomably beautiful gift, and it is impossible here on the incarnational side of things. It has been a very bad match for those of us who were born extremely sensitive. It is so hard and weird that we wonder if we are being punked. And it's filled with heartbreaking sweetness and beauty, floods and babies and acne and Mozart, all swirled together. It's all there. And she's saying, rejoice in it, just like the preacher's saying it. It's all mixed together. And your job is for us to see it all, to see the joy within it, to find the wonder in it. And there's a flip side to that. There's a flip side to not only finding the wonder beneath everything, there's also a task of coming to terms with whatever it is that unsettles you. The preacher says to us in verse 10, remove vexation from your heart. Put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are vanity. What's he getting at there? For all of us, at some point, there is the proverbial rain cloud that walks and seems to follow us. And we wish it would scatter, but it doesn't. But some of us, we almost like being rained on. It's our badge of courage. What the preacher is saying to us is this: yes, I know there are reasons that you are vexed. Yes, I know there are problems that give you great trouble and great exasperation. But you know what? Given the way life is and the wonder that is still in there, you need to come to terms with whatever is in you that vexes you, and you got to root it out. There's just no time for this. Oh my gosh, am I preaching to myself? There's just no time for you to brood on vexation like a drunk man suckles on his vodka. There's no place for it. You have to take stock of whatever is unsettling you. You've got to take it and inventory it. You've got to see it for what it is, and you've got to root it out, because there's just no time for you to waste it thinking about all the things that make you upset. How do you rejoice in this life? You have to seek out the wonder, but you have to scrutinize what unsettles you. That's his worship to us. That's his gift to us. But brothers and sisters, like we've said before, every time we start to think that the preacher actually is going to put on a happy face, everything he says that's bright is always right next door to the shadow. Yes, rejoice in the light you have. But he's also saying to us, rejoice while you can, because soon it's going to be dark. And all you got to do is look at the proportion of words he devotes to that part about darkness compared to the proportion of words he talks about light. And you realize, yeah, he gets the other part. He emphasizes and underscores the second part more than the first. And those seven verses in chapter 12, commentators have been trying to make heads or tails of what he's really talking about ever since he wrote it. Is he being literal? Is he being allegorical? Is he talking about the culmination of all things? Is he being, here's the big word, eschatological, thinking about the last things? Who knows? But I think we could all agree, if you read it again, that at least what he's getting at is this. He's talking about the approach of death. How at first, as death draws near, sweetness is harder and harder to get your hold of. It's harder and harder to savor. It's just the way it is. There's a reason people say it's hell to grow old. Because it is. And anybody that says it isn't hadn't been there yet. He's talking about that as age creeps in upon us. But he's also talking about death itself. In that language there in verses 3 and 4, he's imagining a mourning processional at a wake. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut. Today I went to the dry cleaners to pick up all my suits and guess what? It was shut tight with a big sign, closed for Good Friday. And my children asked, why would they do that? And I said, because they're Christians and there's been a death in the family and his name is Jesus. They're just going to his mourning processional. They're just going in chapters 12, verses 3 and 4 to a mourning processional. He's talking about the approach of death. He's talking about the experience of death. And he's probably also talking about the end of all things. When the sun goes dark and everything gets cold and every last memory is swept away. He's talking about all those things. And the only way he can summarize all his thoughts is to say what he said at the very beginning. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Everything is vanity. It's all absurd. Do you believe him? Do you think that's true? If you don't, just think about Abraham Lincoln for a minute. There's a towering figure. That man's story is worthy of writing books about, and they did. He came from nowhere, from utter anonymity, and ascended to the heights of influence. This man was brilliant. He was the only guy that could have helped and overseen a world, a nation ruptured that it might be healed again. And he saw to its healing, and he spoke like a pastor and a poet. But that man died at a play. He died at a time of relaxation. He thought the war was behind, and he went to a play to enjoy a night out with his wife, and he dies. Brothers and sisters, that's absurd. If you can find any meaning or purpose in it, I tip my tall hat to you. Brothers and sisters, there is no greater explanation or example of absurdity than the one who called himself Jesus. The one who was God, the one who was God of Abraham Lincoln, and the one who was God of you and me. There is no greater absurdity than to say that he died. There is no greater absurdity than for him to have gone to a cross in the way that he did for the reasons that he did. And it's not just absurd that Jesus died. The height of its absurdity is that Jesus had to die. That he had to die for you and for me. That he had to die because you and I put him there. That he had to die because you and I thought we could fix this place. That he had to die because you and I thought we could do something in ourselves to fix what was broken in us. That you and I thought that we could do something that would commend us to God. Oh, brothers and sisters, there is no greater height of absurdity except the absurdity of him walking to his cross. Do you know what Jesus is saying to us by going to his cross? He is not repudiating the absurdity of this world. He is admitting it. He is affirming it at the same time that he is overturning it. and therefore the message, somehow in the midst of listening both to the preacher of Ecclesiastes and to the Lord Jesus himself as he cried out like from Psalm 22 on the cross, is to tell us this point. You and I will never live beyond the absurdity until we embrace it. Until we acknowledge that it is absurd, that so many of our attempts to give answers to difficult questions will never cut mustard. They will never work. And you and I are afraid even to ask them sometimes because our words fail us. But brothers and sisters, Jesus was not afraid. He was not afraid to walk into the height of absurdity of death. And that is why we might trust him as the author and finisher of our faith in the midst of all this absurdity. Zoltan Istvan, a few weeks ago, I wrote about him in the backstory. Remember his story? He's that transhumanist that believes soon we will be able to use technology and be able to overcome death by a consequence of our technology. And I wrote that in the backstory. Guess what? Last week, he wrote a post and he put the backstory in his post to say, look at the weird conservative religious folk. You know why? He says, those weird religious folk, they're threatened by transhumanism because they think what we will accomplish with technology is the reason while everybody else is going to give up on religion. We listen to him and go, you are bonkers, man, to think technology is going to overcome death. And he looks at us and says, you are bonkers for thinking that God will do such a thing. But you know where Zoltan Istvan and you and I are in lockstep together? We both think death is absurd. And so does Jesus. So much so that he was willing to enter into it that he might conquer it. That's why today is good. That's why today is good. I know it's absurd, and I know you're facing absurdity. Every one of us, so am I. But I will follow him, and I will commend him to you because he was not afraid of that.